Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Israel calls ceasefire after UN school shelled, and Islamist militants seize Libyan army base in Benghazi. I'm Bob Doty, reporting from Washington. Israel has called a brief humanitarian ceasefire after Israeli tank shells struck a UN-run school in the Gaza Strip, killing at least 15 people. The planned four-hour halt in fighting was to begin at 3 p.m. local time. The school attack Wednesday happened at the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. VOA Scott Bob visited the site, describing it as a scene of utter chaos. The school is one of 85 sites where the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees says more than 200,000 people are now seeking shelter. A Palestinian health official said earlier the attack killed 20 people. After days of fighting, Islamist groups in Libya have seized the headquarters of the Libyan Special Forces in the eastern city of Benghazi. An Islamist and jihadist alliance, called the Benghazi Revolutionaries Shura Council, announced the capture of the main military base in the eastern city in a statement Wednesday. Libyan army official has also confirmed the takeover. Ansar al-Sharia, which Washington has listed as a terrorist organization, is part of the fighting alliance. About 60 people have died in the violence around Benghazi since Saturday. Russia's central bank promised to support financial institutions hit by new sanctions imposed by the United States and the European Union. Stock markets in Moscow opened lower Wednesday as the measures against Russia's banking, oil, and defense sectors went into effect. Announcing new U.S. sanctions targeting Russia's energy, financial, and defense sectors, President Barack Obama linked the new penalties to the July 17 shootdown of a Malaysian airliner that killed all 298 people on board.
The major sanctions we're announcing today will continue to ratchet up the pressure on Russia, including the cronies and companies that are supporting Russia's illegal actions in Ukraine. In other words, today, Russia is once again isolating itself from the international community, setting back decades of genuine progress. It does not have to be this way. This is a choice that Russia, and President Putin in particular, has made.
In Brussels, ambassadors from the 28-member European Union agreed to new penalties on Russia, including an arms embargo and a ban on trade of equipment for the Russian oil and defense sectors. German Chancellor Angela Merkel said the EU measures against Moscow were unavoidable. U.S. economic growth accelerated sharply in the second quarter of this year, expanding at a 4% annual rate. Wednesday's report from the Commerce Department says the expansion was due to businesses stocking up, increased spending by state and local governments, and growing U.S. exports. The growth in April, May, and June was a big change from the first 3 months of the year, when unusually foul weather hampered business and the economy shrank at a 2% annual rate. Most economists predicted a rebound in the economy, but few said it would be this strong. More than 150 people are feared trapped after a landslide swept through a village in western India. Officials in Maharashtra state say the mudslide buried at least 40 homes in a village early Wednesday. The Inspector General of the National Disaster Response Force said there could be as many as 200 victims. Ghanaian President Alpha Conde has declared a week of mourning after a stampede at a rap concert left at least 33 people dead. The incident occurred late Tuesday on a beach in Conakry, where thousands of people had gathered for the concert to celebrate the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Witnesses say the dead include several children. Reports indicate that the stampede was caused by large numbers of people trying to exit through a small gate. Pakistani soldiers have killed six militants who attacked checkpoints along its rest of northwest border with Afghanistan. Military officials said troops returned fire Tuesday night when a group of roughly 70 militants attacked in the country's Deer District. And Chinese state media are praising the Communist Party's decision to open a corruption probe into retired senior politician Zhou Yongkang. The party announced late Tuesday it is investigating Zhou, China's former security czar, for unspecified serious disciplinary violation. The 71-year-old Zhou, who retired in 2012, was a member of the Politburo Standing Committee, China's highest governing body. It said the Chinese public embraced the probe, saying it's now more convincing to believe all officials. I'm Bob Doty.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
We are now watching West Africa in Liberia and Sierra Leone, where not only do you have the challenges of flooding in those areas, but you also have the challenge of Ebola. We are at the beginning of what could be an escalating food assistance challenge as this health challenge continues to increase.
That was Eteren Kazin, Executive Director of the UN World Food Program. She spoke with VOA's Kim Lewis from Rome. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Islamist groups in Libya have seized the headquarters of the Libyan Special Forces in the eastern city of Benghazi. And British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond calls a meeting on the Ebola crisis.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, after days of fighting, Islamist groups in Libya have seized the headquarters of the Libyan Special Forces in the eastern city of Benghazi. An Islamist and jihadist alliance called the Benghazi Revolutionaries Shura Council announced the capture of the main military base in the eastern city in a statement today. A Libyan army official has also confirmed the takeover. Ansar al-Sharia, which Washington has listed as a terrorist organization, is part of the fighting alliance. It posted pictures on its Facebook page of dozens of weapons it claims it seized during the assault. About 60 people have died in the violence around Benghazi since Saturday. A special forces officer had told the Reuters news agency yesterday that their forces had to abandon their post in the southeast of Benghazi after the Islamist coalition launched a heavy attack.
And in Egypt, three suspected militants were killed today when a car bomb exploded in Giza. Authorities say they believe the car bomb exploded by mistake. Al-Ahram quotes a high-ranking police officer as saying they were likely on their way to carry out a terrorist attack when the car bomb exploded on the outskirts of Cairo.
Coming up on 8 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond says he is holding a meeting today of high-level government officials on the Ebola virus epidemic in West Africa. Hammond says the committee will discuss any necessary precautionary measures to protect British nationals at home and abroad.
There's a lot of people travel from West Africa to the UK and vice versa. So it's sensible for us to meet together, to listen to what the experts have to say, to listen to their advice, and then to decide among ministerial colleagues what action, if any, we need to take.
Hammond says they are not aware of any confirmed Ebola cases in the UK.
The message I want to send out is that by meeting to look at the issues, to evaluate the evidence, we are acting early to make sure that we put in place any necessary precautionary measures to keep the UK safe.
The epidemic began in Guinea and has spread to neighboring Liberia and Sierra Leone and from rural to urban areas. Last weekend, a Liberian national fell ill and died after landing at the airport in Lagos, Nigeria, causing concern that the epidemic could spread further. There is no known cure for Ebola, which is highly contagious and often fatal. As of July 23rd, health officials have recorded more than 670 deaths among more than 1,200 confirmed cases. World Health Organization officials say efforts continue to scale up and strengthen the response to the Ebola outbreak. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders warns that the crisis may only get worse. The French news agency quotes the medical group saying there is no overall strategy to manage the world's worst Ebola outbreak. The International Civil Aviation Organization has met with global health officials on measures to stop the disease from spreading. The organization says the outbreak could lead to flight restrictions to contain it.
New peace talks between South Sudan's warring parties have been delayed by at least a day as the two sides prepare for another round of negotiations. VOA's Gabe Joslow reports that hopes for lasting peace are pinned to the process, which have repeatedly failed to end the seven-month conflict.
The talks between South Sudan's government and the rebel opposition were scheduled to resume Wednesday in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. South Sudan government spokesman Michael Makwe Lueth says negotiators just back to work after the Eid holiday break needed more time to prepare for the talks. But he says they do expect to have a team ready in the coming days. The negotiations were initially due to resume last month, but were delayed because of opposition demands that civil society and diaspora groups be allowed to take part as stakeholders. Lueth says the government has no issue with those demands.
For us as the government, we don't care as to who participates and who does what. What we want is peace. So if increasing the numbers of the participants and so forth or the stakeholders will bring peace, so be it.
Two spokesmen for the opposition also confirmed the talks had been delayed at the government's request, but that their side is ready to resume negotiations when called. Tens of thousands of people have been killed in South Sudan since a political conflict between President Salva Kiir and his main rival Riek Machar descended into inter-ethnic violence in December. The two sides have agreed to three separate ceasefire agreements in talks organized by the East African Group of Nations, IGAD, but all of the deals have been violated soon after signing. David Deng, research director for the South Sudan Law Society, says there is measured optimism about these talks, despite their failure to produce a lasting deal so far.
So I think people are sober in terms of how they assess the possibilities for peace coming out of the process, but at the same time hopeful, and I think aware that there's no other game in town, and there's a lot riding on this process.
An agreement in June called for a transitional government that was to be established by the second week of August, but because of delays to the negotiations and continued fighting, that deadline is unlikely to be met. Deng says in order for the two sides to move towards substantive matters of reconciliation, there must first be a lasting ceasefire.
A very important thing to watch out for is the sort of responses of the groups on the ground in the coming days and weeks. And if we can see them, you know, to hold off in terms of aggressive action towards one another, hopefully that can leave enough room for parties then to begin engaging on some of these political questions moving forward.
According to the United Nations, more than 1 million South Sudanese have been displaced by violence since the conflict began, while aid agencies have warned that some parts of the country are at risk of falling into famine. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Nairobi.
World Food Program Executive Director Ertharin Cousin has just returned from a visit to Malakal, South Sudan, where she assessed the food security situation firsthand. Violence and insecurity have forced over 1 million people to flee their homes. Those who are not in internally displaced persons' camps are living in the bush with no access to food or water. She spoke with me about ongoing efforts of the WFP in partnership with other humanitarian organizations to reach those people who are in desperate need of assistance.
We are, as you know, working to meet the food assistance needs of the million people who are now internally displaced across South Sudan as a result of the ongoing fighting and conflict in the country. What we saw in Malakal was a ghost town, a city that all of the residents have abandoned their homes because of the threat of violence and are now living either in the UN facility or they are walking trying to find assistance, many of them now in neighboring countries. Imagine this. Many of them are living walking distance from what was their home, and now they're living in a tent in a UN facility with no access to food other than what we are providing.
How long do you think they will be able to sustain themselves like this?
We are completely dependent upon donor contributions to support our work that will ensure that these people do not go hungry, that we meet the nutrition needs of children for the length of the conflict. The reason we went to South Sudan, Tony Lake, who's the head of UNICEF, and I last week, was because it's those people who are living in the areas outside of the cities, in the rural areas, the more remote areas where we have no UN camps, that we have limited access to because of the conflict in Unity State and Jonglei State and Upper Nile, that we are worried about. Well, we have teams that are going out and working to try and meet the food assistance needs of people who are in the bush, who otherwise are depending on eating the wild roots and drinking water from the Nile because they don't have access to food and water.
There are other hot spots across the continent as well. Can you tell us about some of them, such as the drought in Somalia, how that's affecting people, and the instability in Central African Republic is also another big concern.
Today is not yet at crisis level, but we are watching the escalating challenges of food assistance as a result of the drought. And it is an area that, as you know, in that southwestern area of Somalia, the international community still has very limited access there because of Al-Shabaab. But we are committed to trying to reach as many people as possible in Somalia. In Central African Republic, because of the ongoing fighting between the Seleka, the anti-Seleka and Balaka forces, there are areas outside of Bangui that we have very limited access to, which is forcing many people to leave Central African Republic and go into Chad and Cameroon, where we are working to meet both the food assistance and nutrition needs. It's a very, very challenging time in the humanitarian response community because we have an unprecedented number of ongoing man-made conflicts where the victims of those conflicts do not have regular access to food. We're concerned about the growing challenges of Nigeria that are forcing people across Cameroon into Chad. We're seeing more people moving in that area. And you also have Mali, which northern Mali continues to be a man-made conflict that affects populations and forces them to move. While simultaneously you have the challenges of climate-impacted food insecurity in Somalia, and we are now watching West Africa in Liberia and Sierra Leone, where not only do you have the challenges of flooding in those areas, but you also have the challenge of Ebola.
How does Ebola or the threat of Ebola affect food security?
Well, anytime you have a challenge that impacts the movement of populations that are rural populations that are dependent upon access to markets to meet their food assistance needs, you have the potential for a food assistance challenge. We are continuing to operate in those areas. We have teams both in Sierra Leone and Liberia today, and those teams are continuing to work. We're working with WHO to report the performance of that work with the appropriate safety on tools in mind to ensure that our humanitarian workers are not impacted by the health challenges there while they still work to meet people's food security needs. But I think that we are at the beginning of what could be an escalating food assistance challenge as this health challenge continues to increase.
That was Ertharin Cousin, Executive Director of the UN World Food Program. She spoke with me from Rome.
Guinean President Alpha Conde has declared a week of mourning after a stampede at a rap concert left at least 33 people dead. The incident occurred late yesterday on a beach in Conakry, where thousands of people had gathered for a concert to celebrate the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. Witnesses say the dead include several children. Reports indicate the stampede was caused by large numbers of people trying to exit through a small gate. A statement from the presidency called the incident a tragic drama, but did not give a death toll. The government said it is investigating.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 20 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Islamist groups in Libya have seized the headquarters of the Libyan Special Forces in the eastern city of Benghazi. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond calls a meeting on the Ebola crisis. And new peace talks between South Sudan's warring parties have been delayed by at least a day as the two sides prepare for another round of negotiations. And would like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at African News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
The United Nations is calling for an end to human trafficking as it marks the first World Day Against Trafficking in Persons. Lisa Schlein in Geneva has more on this modern form of slavery.
The World Day Against Trafficking in Persons comes 4 years after the UN General Assembly adopted a global action plan to combat the crime. This plan focuses on preventing trafficking, prosecuting offenders, and protecting victims. It calls on states to set up national programs that implement these measures. Human rights activists regard this day as another significant step in the fight against this modern form of slavery. Yula Hadadin, advisor on human trafficking to the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, tells VOA the sale and exploitation of people for economic gain occurs all over the world. She says no country is immune from this crime.
It takes place in farms, in factories, in private households. For me, this is the most serious form when you subject people to servitude and abuse them as domestic workers. It takes place in the form of exploiting prostitution of others or forced prostitution. It takes many, many different forms. Nowadays, we can see a lot of forced marriages, and forced marriages are a form of trafficking.
This criminal flesh trade flourishes because it is highly lucrative. The International Labor Organization reports traffickers, employers, and organized crime rake in $150 billion a year from commercial sexual exploitation and forced economic exploitation. The ILO estimates 21 million men, women, and children are victims of forced labor and forced prostitution. It reports the Asia-Pacific region accounts for the largest number of forced laborers in the world, followed by Africa and Latin America. Hadadin says it is difficult to pinpoint the root causes of human trafficking. She notes there are many factors that make people vulnerable to exploitation.
Certain groups are subjected to violence, discrimination in all its forms. Poverty can be a contributing factor. I wouldn't say it's a root cause, but rather it's a contributing factor. Because not all poor people are victims of trafficking. Some victims are even from rich families. You know, people choose to immigrate to other countries seeking a better life. And it turns that they become victims of trafficking because no clear immigration policies are in place.
The United Nations is using the event to raise public awareness of the horrific violations suffered by millions of victims of trafficking. It says such violence and abuse must not go unpunished. Since human trafficking occurs in all countries, the UN says all governments must work to end this hideous practice. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
New research shows urbanization may be bad for people's health unless planners develop cities that allow healthier lifestyles and environments. The UN estimates much of the developing and developed world will be urbanized by 2050. VOA's Jody Capua reports.
Rural sub-Saharan Africa is seeing rapidly increasing urbanization, something researchers say could lead to an explosion in rates of heart disease and diabetes. They estimate more than 500 million people now live in rural areas of the continent, where there are lower rates of non-communicable diseases. But that's changing, and they warn that even small changes toward urbanization could affect health. Dr. Manjinder Sandhu is the joint senior author of the study, which appears in the journal Plus Medicine.
We think in lots of low and middle-income countries around the world, and not specifically to countries in Africa, that one is going to see a massive change in the burden of such diseases, such as diabetes and heart disease. And this comes together with an existing high burden of endemic infection and chronic infectious diseases, but also this parallel rise in these non-communicable diseases.
He says chronic infections can worsen the effects of non-communicable diseases that accompany urbanization.
Chronic infections can lead to an increased risk of such diseases, for example, HIV, its treatment, and the potential risk of those factors on heart disease and diabetes risk. We know that hepatitis C virus is an oncogenic virus, it's a cancer-causing virus, and together with HIV may increase the risk of cancers.
Urbanization does have an upside, with greater access to education and healthcare, for example. But researchers warn it can be a double-edged sword. With urbanization, there are also lifestyle changes, such as adopting a more Western diet that's high in fat, sugar, and salt, less physical activity, greater alcohol consumption, and weight gain.
We can see a compounding effect of all these interrelated risk factors on increasing the burden of risk. And I think Africa is a good exemplar of trying to understand urbanicity, but also it's a good example of where this could occur again in other regions around the world where similar events and scenarios and environments are occurring.
Dr. Sandhu is with the Department of Public Health and Primary Care at the University of Cambridge and the Wellcome Trust Sanger Institute. Researchers base their findings on more than 7,300 people living in 25 villages in Uganda. Each person in the study was given what's called an urbanicity score. It measures lifestyle risk factors as rural areas become more urbanized.
The interesting thing about studying rural communities is that one can see that the civil infrastructure is relatively nascent. It's a building and growing infrastructure. And if one can think about what facets of that changing infrastructure is potentially associated with risk of non-communicable diseases, one may think about addressing and perhaps changing or building an environment that is more conducive to a healthy lifestyle.
Sandhu says risk factors created by urbanization should be considered when coming up with replacements for the expiring Millennium Development Goals.
I think that should be a paramount goal to at least consider how the impact of those changing civil infrastructures are potentially leading to a change in lifestyle and other behavioral risk factors that are leading to an increased risk of chronic diseases such as diabetes and heart disease.
Joining Cambridge researchers in the study were those from the Uganda Virus Research Institute, Australia's Deakin University, and the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehei Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi right here in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami. Thanks for joining us. We love to have you on board. This is Upfront on The Voice of America. Hot, hot.
Upfront is a show that explores issues
that affect your daily lives. Don't move that dial. Get your snacks, get your cup of tea or your cup of coffee. Put your feet up. This is Upfront. Cheers, cheers. Clink, clink.
Yeah, now there's the youth culture that is being practiced by the youth globally.
Okay, yeah.
feel like the problem is that once the funds are sent to these developing countries, it sometimes gets in the wrong hands, and then it's the actual people that are supposed to be benefiting from these funds really never even get to see.
What does this mean for your local culture? Is it being threatened? Should your parents be worried? Let's talk. This is Upfront of the Voice of America. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle is at Upfront Africa. And remember, you can always send us an email here on the show. It's upfront@voanews.com.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Islamist groups in Libya have seized the headquarters of the Libyan Special Forces in the eastern city of Benghazi. British Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond calls a meeting on the Ebola crisis, and new peace talks between South Sudan's warring parties have been delayed by at least a day as the two sides prepare for another round of negotiations. Coming up, we have music from Sierra Leone, and in our feature segment, we focus on the deadly Ebola virus that has killed more than 600 people in four West African countries. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sunny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand Commonwealth Games boxing tops your sports report this evening.
Kim, it's the seventh day of competition at the Commonwealth Games in Glasgow, Scotland. In the boxing ring Wednesday, heavyweights from Nigeria and Kenya had mixed results in their quarterfinal bouts. Efetobor Opochi of Nigeria was in a jubilant mood after beating Australia's Jai Opataya. Reports from Glasgow say Opochi almost wrecked the ring with some boisterous and booming somersaults, and then he shook his hips in celebration. Meanwhile, Kenya's Charles Okoth was in a more somber mood after losing his heavyweight fight to New Zealand's David Light. Moving down in weight, another Kenyan, Benson Ngengiru, was victorious in his bantamweight quarterfinal. Benson beat Tafari Ebanks of the Cayman Islands. Elsewhere, fighters from Uganda and South Africa lost their quarterfinal bouts Wednesday in the bantamweight division. Uganda's Bashir Nasir lost to Michael Conlan of Northern Ireland, and South Africa's Ayabongo Sonjika lost his fight against Sean McGoldrick of Wales. Still in Glasgow, the results of a B sample for a Nigerian weightlifter who flunked a doping test at the Commonwealth Games are expected Thursday. Chika Amalaha, the gold medalist in the women's 53-kilogram division, was found to have taken two drugs that are banned as diuretics and masking agents. The B sample, which will confirm or deny the original sample, was sent to a laboratory in London accredited by WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency. Amalaha is provisionally suspended. If the result is upheld, she could appear before the Commonwealth Games Federation Court and have her medal stripped. Mike Hooper, who is from New Zealand, is also the chief executive officer of the Commonwealth Games Federation. Regarding Amalaha's case, he says, and I quote, "We shouldn't presume anything just yet." Hooper says a total of 731 samples have been taken since July 13th. Of those, 321 were pre-competition and 410 were during competition. In Commonwealth Games competition Tuesday, Joyce Chepkirui led a Kenyan sweep of the medals in the women's 10,000 meters race, as we hear now from our Daybreak Africa sportsman, Mark Ouma.
Joyce Chepkirui clocked 32 minutes and 9.35 seconds to lead Florence Kiplagat and Emily Chibet in a 1-2-3 Kenyan medal podium sweep in women's 10,000 meters in athletics on Tuesday. Later, 20-year-old Faith Chepngetich Kipyegon prevailed in the women's 1,500 meters in 4 minutes and 8.94 seconds, while in women's 400 meters, Botswana's Amantle Moncho was fourth, followed by Nigerian Folashade Abuga. Sudan. Meanwhile, in swimming, South African Chad Leclos bagged a bronze medal in men's individual 200-meter medley relay. Staying in Glasgow, South Africa is seventh on the medal table as at Tuesday. They have amassed 9 gold, 7 silver and 10 bronze medals. Kenya is 10th, Nigeria 12th, Cameroon 15th, Mozambique 20th and Namibia 25th, while Ghana, Mauritius, Uganda and Zambia share the 26th spot with one bronze medal each out of 33 nations and territories on the medal chart.
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOAnews.com.
And when you visit VOAnews.com, make sure you check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog, in which I write about a variety of sporty topics. My latest blog post is titled 8 World Cups, and I write about a new book by George Vesey, longtime sports columnist for the New York Times newspaper. In the book, the 75-year-old Vesey reflects on some of his experiences covering the 8 World Cup football tournaments before Brazil 2014. For our VOA listeners keeping score, that would be Spain 1982, Mexico 1986, Italy 1990, USA 1994, France 1998, Japan, South Korea 2002, Germany 2006, and South Africa 2010. My VOA colleague Park Brewer reached George Vesey by phone in New York and asked him, which World Cup was your favorite as a reporter?
Well, I want to sound like a parent here, which I am, and say, oh, I never have any favorites because everyone is different, everyone is special, blah, blah, blah. Now, I could look at it this way and say that the first one is always going to be special because it is first, and that was the one where Italy won, and I started off in Barcelona with that great group of Brazil, Argentina, and Italy. And then if you'd say, well, which one was your favorite as an individual, you know, the World Cups have been held in so many great places that the fun of living in these cities, I mean, 4 or 5 of them, my wife was with me. We rented apartments, if we were lucky enough, in Paris and Rome. So it's very hard. I know the one that I feel like I missed the most that I just didn't see was the one in the United States because the country is so big and I had to fly around. Also, I was living at home, so I didn't quite get, you know, when I was around New York, so I didn't quite get the feel of it that I did for the others.
Who was your favorite World Cup personality to cover?
If I say favorite, the guy I write about the most in the book is probably Maradona because I was witness in 82, about 10 rows up from the field, watching him get beaten up by Claudio Non Molto Gentile, not very gentle at all, and just pounding him, kicking Maradona. And then I wound up covering him in 86 with Before the Hand of God and being around him. And then in 90, I was trying to interview him, and I tell the story in the book about how I tried to make a phone call from the States to his house. Somebody gave me his number. And what happened when I made the phone call, I started first in my Italian, my bad Italian, and then I switched to my bad Spanish, and this guy kept goofing with me on the phone. And then the punchline is who that actually was, and that's in the book.
George, how has covering the World Cup changed through the years? Obviously, it's more widely followed now than ever before, but certainly the changes in technology have had a huge impact for both writers and broadcasters and the way they reach their audiences.
Well, there's no doubt about it. I included some of this in the book. My editor said, well, people don't really care that much about the way you work. But I think that people who have come along in the computer age, who have seen things grow, can appreciate that the game of soccer didn't necessarily totally change in eight World Cups. But electronics, the way we, and not we the journalists, but the way we the world do our business. So from a point of view of writing, when I started in 1982, I was working with a machine, a great big clumpy machine that actually had no battery backup. It had to operate on electric power. So somebody cut off the electricity in the press box after a game one night, not realizing what those people, and it totally blew out my machine. I had to go out and buy new parts to it to make it work the next day. So there is that. And then in terms of information, I couldn't look things up in 1982. There was no internet. FIFA doesn't give out much information anyway. They don't believe in really helping the reporters much. So it was hard to even get rosters of who people were. You go forward to 2010, and in South Africa, they had terrific electronics. Wherever you went, you could look up the players' backgrounds. You could look up, and everything graduated. The other thing to talk about electronics is the social media, how that affected things. I mean, 1982, I would file by computer, to be sure, by telephone, and you'd be like throwing a story in the bottle. You didn't even know how it was being received because you didn't see the newspaper till you got home. By 2010, and certainly in 2006, fans were using the social media to come back at you during games. Like you'd be getting emails from people saying, what's with that Bruce Arena? Why isn't he playing DeMarcus Beasley on the left side? Why is he playing him on the right side? Everybody knows he's got a love. And you'd be looking at this stuff and saying, those fans are right in the game at regular time, at warp time, and they're participating in just like the players.
That's George Vesey, the longtime sports columnist for the New York Times newspaper. George has a new book out titled Eight World Cups, and he was talking from New York with my VOA colleague Park Brewer. Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOASunny. You'll see photos and videos at my Facebook page, and you can also post your comments. And my Twitter handle is @VOASunnySports. In pro basketball news, the Los Angeles Lakers have introduced former guard Byron Scott as their new head coach. Scott won three NBA championships with the Lakers during his playing days. At the news conference in Los Angeles, three former Lakers greats, Magic Johnson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and Jamal Wilkes, were all on hand, and all three paid Byron Scott tribute. They seemed to give a big thumbs up. Scott does have previous coaching experience in the NBA. He took the New Jersey Nets to consecutive NBA finals in 2002 and 2003. Scott has also coached the New Orleans Hornets and the Cleveland Cavaliers. Byron Scott, the new head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, our feature series on the Young Africa Leaders Initiative Summit going on in Washington, D.C. And next, we focus on the deadly Ebola virus that has killed more than 600 people in four West African countries so far. But first, some music. Here is Fulani from Sierra Leone with African Children.
Fulani future in apocalypse, smoke. Ella, black. Get up, yo. For the children, yo. History. I and I, my brethren, born in Konoko, Dutown, Sepadu, 15 Bangwa, Sri Land of Gold and Diamond. My mother, the many swear, Papa moved to the city of Freetown. We sat at 45 regions with Bambalato, within the Nadaya, and I was by the bridge, so hungry. At night, like Mot, Arata, go eat on the Futo. Hello, the gold. But when morning comes, me go feel pain under me foot. Hello, African children, please, please stop your crying. Keep your head up. African children, cries, please stop your crying. Keep your head up. African children, cries, please stop.
Remember, we used to walk 6 miles every other morning. Touch bucket filled with water, pan, we head me neck and back. Paper and fire, yeah. Body all in pain, feel sick. Membrane inside after, we go memorize the only Quran with our Bible. Bible. Go to school, hot mental. Teacher go beat with for timetable, Lord.
Jesus Christ, and children are like the kingdom of God. We don't turn we back from within them. Not to their fault. You can kick an old man for what he is, but you can't kick a young thug. Bad bush not there for to where we begin them. Children should be educated, nourished, healthy. Them life go flourish. For our children are the future. It takes a village to raise a child. The valley of a shed is not known until he cut down the tree. I said, for money, said,
one Africa, one unity. One black people, one destiny.
African children cry, please stop your crying.
Weep your head up.
African children cry, please stop your crying.
Keep your head up.
African children cry, please stop your crying.
Keep your head up.
African children cry, please stop your crying.
Please keep your head up.
Danko fire,
Danko,
Alawadi Barki, a Bengure, Danko ne, Danko ba,
Danko,
Alawadi Barki, a Aduna,
yeah,
what?
He may wale, Dange, Julia,
keep your head up,
He may wale, Dange, Julia,
Keep your head up, never give up. Even though the position
Sierra Leone's Fulani with African children.
Well, hundreds of young Africans have spent several weeks in the United States. They've been participating in a program meant to enhance leadership skills, encourage entrepreneurship, and connect young African leaders with one another and with Americans. The initiative was launched by U.S. President Barack Obama in 2010 and has since held 15 exchanges and sponsored over 1,200 sub-Saharan scholars to visit America. This week, President Obama said the program will be renamed the Nelson Mandela Washington Young African Leaders Fellowship in 2016. Nigerian Sane Dantuni Bello is one of the 2014 fellows. He spoke with VOA's Vincent McCorry from our Washington studios about the importance of attending the leadership conference.
I feel that I require more skills. I need to sharpen my skills, leadership skills. I need to learn more in terms of partnership, because in my agency, we adopted what we call the four P's paradigm in preventing human trafficking. Yes. Prevention, prosecution, protection, and partnership. So I'm here in the United States to learn more about protection, prevention, and partnership.
Now, up to this point, do you feel like you have something that you're going to go back home with, which you will say, this is new, this is different?
Yeah, for me, Vincent, the journey to this Washington Fellowship was an experience on itself. You know, there were more than 15,000 applications from Nigeria, from which only 45 fellows were selected. And coming here to the United States, my host institution, Howard University, I have been exposed to a broader understanding of public management models and practices. I have also had the opportunity to interact with a cross-section of government officials from Capitol Hill to the State Department. And I have also been able to meet with non-governmental organizations like Polaris Project and Coalition Against Child Labor. So I think I have learned a lot to take back with me to Nigeria.
How confident are you that when you go back and you talk to those that you work with, perhaps some of your superiors, they will understand that you need to inject a few fresh, different, new ideas in the way you run things over there?
Luckily enough for me, I work with an agency that appreciates and welcomes change, innovation, and creativity. So I think I will have no difficulty getting those my new skills across. My agency is basically an agency, the workforce, are basically a young person with appetite for change. So I believe I will have no difficulty getting my ideas across.
So very quickly, what's your overall assessment of the YALI initiative?
Well, I think the YALI initiative has been largely successful, not just because that we come here to America to acquire new skills, but because it has laid a very solid foundation of partnership between the next generation of African leaders and America. Also, the YALI have created a platform, a social media platform. It has created a big network where young African leaders can come together, interact and share ideas. I think that is a huge success on itself.
I suppose you've met people here from different African countries that you would never have met if you were on the continent.
Yes. And I would say to my African leaders, young African leaders, they should aspire to serve before they aspire to lead.
That was Sani Dantuni Bello, a Young African Leadership Initiative Fellow. He spoke with VOA's Vincent McCorry in our Washington studios.
The deadly Ebola virus has killed more than 600 people in four West African countries. Sierra Leone has lost more than 220 lives since the first case was reported in Kelahun district on May 25th. Another 500 have tested positive and are receiving treatment. The nation's healthcare specialists and key stakeholders are stepping up their fight against the dreaded virus. Reporter Patrick Jakema has more on the story from the country's second largest city, Bo.
The first case of Ebola was reported in Kailan district on May 25th after a nurse came into contact with an Ebola carrier and later died. Since then, the death toll has been steadily increasing, especially in the eastern district of Kailan and Kenema. Doctors say the Ebola virus could be contacted by contact with body fluids from someone who is infected. That includes touching or washing of the body of an Ebola victim. Caregivers may come into contact with diarrhea, vomit, semen and blood from the infected family member. Scientists also warn against eating wildlife that carry Ebola, including monkeys, chimpanzees, wild antelope, fruit bats and other bushmeat. In the last 2 months, health workers have mounted crusade against Ebola through radio broadcasts, street shows, workshops and community outreach. The effort aims to educate the public about the spread of the virus and to explain how the use of disinfectants like chlorine, soaps, detergents can kill it on common surfaces. The campaign is supported by UN agencies, the International Rescue Committee, the Irish NGO called GOAL, government and other donors. A police source says 70 police personnel have been deployed at various entry points in the district of Kailan, Kenema, to allow health workers to screen passengers coming from Ebola-affected communities. The rationale is to restrict the movement of the people and prevent the spread of the disease. People with high fevers are further tested for malaria and typhoid. Those suspected of having Ebola are quarantined. The deputy matron of the Kenema Government Hospital, Finda Josephine Saidu, says doctors have stepped up the fight. She elaborates on the Ebola Center, which is managed by four doctors, two local and two foreign.
Basically, we are managing the cases. As we all know, these are palliative cases. We don't have specific treatment for Ebola. We are just managing the symptoms that are coming up, more especially in terms of replacing the fluid loss that patients come in with, vomiting and diarrhea. And sometimes the bleeding, we do use some anticoagulant at least to stop the bleeding. Basically, we are just using some palliative treatment to manage these cases.
Josephine Saidu mentioned how devastating the Ebola virus has been, especially on health workers at the management unit.
Now health workers are being involved. But as some of us, this is a new disease condition that has come into our country, and we have sacrificed to work with this particular unit. We are still doing our research, because by the way our health workers are being infected, even the preparation, let's say we have these PPEs when you are going in there, that protect personal protective equipment. If you don't know how to dispose of this protective equipment, you will protect others. But in the other way around, you will infect yourself. For Kenema District, 13 nurses have died. And presently, as I'm speaking, 6 of them are admitted in the hospital.
She added that nurses are putting their lives on the line to save the country from the epidemic, and are urging the public to report suspected cases early to the hospital. She said Ebola is real and can be prevented if reported early. In related development, a local task force has been created to better control the disease. In one recent briefing, Mayor of Kenema City Council Joseph Kefala says the fight against Ebola needs to be localized.
As part of our activity, councillors and ward committee members should be seen championing the fight against Ebola at ward levels. They will support the surveillance team, report suspected Ebola cases to the center, promote the use of chlorine, and complement the efforts of the social mobilization team.
He urged the public to cooperate with health workers in surveillance and control. He asked people not to discriminate against disease survivors, and thus is working at the Ebola Management Unit. I mean, health workers say there are a lot of misconceptions about Ebola. A few weeks ago, the police arrested a man who allegedly assaulted a nurse, accusing her of having the illness. Some believe nurses carry the disease or inject illness into the people. Cases have been reported of suspected Ebola carriers refusing to get into ambulances and families abandoning crops so that health workers cannot follow them. The religious community believes that the fight against Ebola needs a spiritual approach. Special prayers are offered in mosques and churches. Health workers say the fight against Ebola in Sierra Leone will continue until the disease finally dies out. Specialist says outbreaks normally last for about 3 months if adequate steps are taken to fight the virus. Already, there have been few reported suspected cases in the capital, Freetown, and other provincial towns, but government is making frantic effort to eliminate the disease. For VOA Africa, I am Bart Jackima reporting from the second largest city, Bo, Sierra Leone.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhim in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopez, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
500 young men and women from across Africa will gather in Washington, part of our nation's long-term effort to support and invest in Africa's next generation of educators, entrepreneurs, activists, and leaders. The Young African Leaders Initiative, organized by President Barack Obama in 2010, will allow those attending to learn from one another while giving U.S. policymakers a chance to learn how best to support African youth's vision for the future of their countries. About 60% of Africa's population is below the age of 35. Nearly one in three is between 10 and 24. It is clear, then, that Africa's future is with its youth. They will provide the energy, new initiatives, and new ideas to carry their nations forward. In 2014, 500 young leaders from sub-Saharan Africa, ages 25 to 35 years old, were selected to take part in the program, which provides academic courses at participating colleges and universities in the U.S., internships in their interests with companies and organizations, and a conference in Washington. Similar efforts for youth development, albeit on a smaller scale, are conducted by U.S. embassies across Africa. It's hoped that bringing sub-Saharan Africa's brightest young minds and leaders together in this way will allow them to learn from each other and help them deal with the challenges they and their countries face. Africa holds extraordinary promise, and the U.S. is committed to a partnership with it to fulfill that potential.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, voanews.com/editorials.
VOA.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.